Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for being here, and I would like to also thank the organizers for putting this symposium together. And can you all hear me? Okay, good. We won't ask if you all want to hear me, but that's another story. Oh, yeah, but you may be here for the second and third speaker. Okay, and so the title of my talk will be Next Generation Wheat Breeding in the Post-Sequence Era. And I do want to acknowledge my co-authors, Vikas Palanker, Ibrahim Albassoni, Amanda Easterly, Nicholas Garst, and, of course, Jesse Poland. Okay, so what am I doing wrongly now? Okay, there we go. I'm going to start out a little bit differently than you normally have in an agronomy meeting, but this is a quote from Henry David Thoreau. Our inventions are wont to be pretty toys which distract our attention from serious things. They are but improved means to an unimproved end, an end which is already but too easy to arrive at, as railroads lead to Boston or New York. We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. And so what I want to do is I want to put this in the context. I am an applied breeder, okay? And I'm going to go after problems that stick in my craw, okay? And we're going to basically think about how we can use these new set of tools. But what we communicate is what's always important, okay? So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we can do with the crop genome sequence, why plant breeders change their breeding methods, the questions that all plant breeders have to answer. This is what we communicate. These are the things that are fundamental. Breeding in the post-genomic sequence era and the difference between strategy and tactics. Now, this is the slide that I guess everybody's got to have. My postdoc told me that to have credibility, you got to show how cheap sequencing has become. It's like the hybrid yield slide in corn, but for sequencing, you got to show this, okay? Bottom line is we can do things now because it's inexpensive. You can sequence the human genome for $1,000 a pop. It's about the same size as the corn genome. Wheat's a little bit five times bigger, but sequencing costs have become markedly less. Frankly, we're transitioning from markers to sequence-based genotyping. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're getting extremely high-density SNPs. And I got to give a real shout-out to the International Wheat Genome Sequencing Consortium. They just released a new assembly in June of 2016, and it's huge. It's made a big difference. And we're nowhere near where the rice, the Arabidopsis, the maize genome is. But this is still a huge improvement. So now, what can we do? What has this allowed us to do? Well, it greatly improves our SNP calls and imputations from our genotype by sequencing data. Okay? And we use GBS because it's cheap. Okay? We routinely now can build linkage maps in biparental populations with well over 4,000 markers, polymorphic markers, which is at least twice what we're able to do. And one of my students has a poster this afternoon, if you're curious to see, Wasim Hussein, on what that looks like. We have, on average, over 200 markers per chromosome on each of our 21 chromosomes. Our genome map is about 2,000 centimorgans. So you see we're getting a very, very dense map. For GWAS, or genome-wide association studies, and for genomic selection, we have tens of thousands of markers. 2016, we had 95,000 useful SNPs for our genomic selection. And the key thing here is we use our molecular assisted selection, MAS, in our enrichment in early generations, and we're genotyping for most of the traits in the later generation because you've already got the data. And with genome-wide SNPs combined with the phenotypic data, we now can really investigate the architecture of very complex traits such as yield and our development of superior cultivars. Now, why do plant breeders change? It's to do two things. One is if you're able to do something you couldn't do in the past, that's novelty, or because you're able to do something that you could do in the past, but you can do it much more efficiently or less expensively, and that's efficiency. And that's where the post-genome sequence attracts plant breeding, novelty and efficiency, and we use it for both. So what are the questions that every plant breeder has to ask? Okay? The first one is how do you handle spatial variation in trials? So I'll give you some examples of that. How do you handle early generation unreplicated designs, especially when you have an overlay of spatial variation? How do you handle years when you have uniform data or bad data? Okay? Do you just give up, or do you kind of push through? Epistasis, genotype by environmental interactions, and of course, every breeding program is limited by resources. So, here's an example of spatial variation. Let's see if I can do this. This one is a standard winter in Nebraska. I want you to notice the bands of snow. That's insulation. Any plot that's underneath a band of snow has less winter kill than any one that's not. In the spring, when that snow melts, they have more moisture than one that's not under a band of snow. Now, do those look like those were nicely placed across your replicates? That's what you have to deal with in spatial variation. This is what drought looks like in the spring. You can see, again, more spatial variation. Frankly, the best wheat ground is the worst ground that corn can be grown on, because they grow corn in preference to wheat, and so we always get the most spatially variable land for our growers. Now, just to put it in perspective again, we have a site at McCook, and if you look at 2012 to 2015, each one of these is a spatial correction. Each one is different. None of them were known a priori, so you just run them all and find which one fits your data. That's routinely what I have to deal with. This is a different trial, but you can see this is sort of a heat map. You can see how the spatial variation occurs. We always have to correct for that. Now, if you go into early generation unreplicated designs, and this is where I think most breeding programs are the most vulnerable, especially if you are like my program, where the early generations are near campus and your main breeding sites or locations are away from campus. We routinely plant 40 to 50,000 headrows. We cull heavily here. That's visual selection. We don't have the time to spend and or the money to do genomic selection on those. However, we're now, from those 40 to 50,000, we get 1,600 to 1,800 preliminary observation plots. F3-derived F5s, we do genomic or GBS on all those. Okay, we select 250 of those for our preliminary yield trial, which is tested at 8 locations in an augmented design. Okay, we can't afford to replicate plots. We don't have either the seed or the resources to do it. But we can replicate across markers, and that becomes an internal replication that's extremely valuable. I've never liked replicating across markers because I've always felt you can replicate in the field. But in your early generations, you have no choice. Okay? We can also link this year's data and our genomic estimates to last year's data and the previous year's data. And that becomes extremely valuable. Okay? I still prefer replications. Everything I do is in a 3-rep augmented alpha lattice design. Okay? And one thing that's going to come out of this is I may need to change the breeding program because F3-derived lines are too heterogeneous to really get good. There's a lot of slippage in your markers because there's such heterogeneity in an F3-derived line. Okay? Now, let's talk a little bit about years when you get uniform or bad data. So this is an evapotranspiration map of Nebraska. One-third of our wheat is grown here, one-third of our wheat is grown here, one-third of our wheat is grown there. My initial nurseries are here with a backup site there. Okay? There is a huge gradient across the state in a normal year. So if you look at it, normally, all due to moisture, a trend east to west. Okay? Normally, we're 4 metric tons per hectare in the east, maybe 5, and on the west, we're 2 metric tons. Okay? However, once in a while, you get a wet year, and you get 4 metric tons everywhere, which is meaningless. It doesn't represent the target environment that you're really trying to breed for. And it drives me crazy because I have 8 trials telling me the same information. Okay? So how do you look at this data? You know, it's as useful when you have a severe winter kill or when you have severe drought. You have bad data, and you've got to somehow keep the program rolling forward. Okay? Now, I just want to show you this because this shows you why we cluster. This is from the Northern Regional Performance Nurseries. You can see there's 2 major ecozones in Nebraska. If you use the Southern Regional Performance data, you can see there's, in fact, 3 major ecozones. Those are the 3 that I should be breeding for. Okay? So that's what you have to remember. Now, let's talk about bad data. This happened just this last summer. Okay, we had a major hail event come through our main nurseries at Lincoln. So now these are four different fields which we have our wheat plots on. The hailstorm came basically like this. Okay, this field was severely damaged. This field was partially damaged. This field was relatively untouched, and this field was untouched. Okay. So the question is, you know, we had in this case 13% of our lines were relatively untouched. 45% had moderate damage. 42% were severely damaged. We're looking at 50% yield losses. Now, we cut every one of those, and we were happy to do that because we could get seed to plant the next year. So I had yield data on all of that, but it was meaningless, okay? Can you use a grid selection? Well, you could if you thought hail was reproducible, and the answer is not in my lifetime. Or could you use genomic selection to help? Okay. So this is what the plots looked like when we had a beautiful field. That's what the storm looked like, and that's what it looked like after the storm, just to put it in perspective. That's not exactly a representative yield plot. So this is work that Vikas, who works with me, my postdoc, and he's going to present it on Wednesday afternoon very late, the integration of genomic selection into our breeding program. And we're going to look at the ability to predict performance of new lines, improve the accuracy of selection decisions, recycling lines earlier into our crossing block, and saving costs on phenotyping. Now, we used four independent nurseries. They're the preliminary yield trials, okay? We did it from 2012 to 2015. They are tested at all these sites. Some get lost to hail, some to drought, other things, okay? Initially, we did 280 entries. We went to 270 new experimental lines. We wanted to increase the checks, decrease the incomplete block design. Okay. We have phenotypic data. Each was analyzed separately. Each was corrected for spatial variation. We GBS everything. Okay. And then our genomic selection, we use the BGLR package with customized R scripts, and we use the RKH package. Okay. This gives you an idea of what our fields look like. Our experimental design, I should say. Our coverage is pretty good. This just to see whether or not we've got good quality SNPs. About 27,000 in 2015. Okay, 114 on the smallest marked chromosome, 4D, over 3,300 on 3B, which is the largest chromosome in wheat, an average of 1,200 SNPs per chromosome. Now, this slide is a little bit confusing, and I apologize for its size, but basically each year is color-coded. And what we wanted to look here was to look for structure. We saw no obvious structure. We saw what to me is fairly remarkable that the diversity within the population stays somewhat similar from year to year. And it also tells me as a breeder that we have lots of diversity. I always want to make sure I'm not limiting diversity because we want to make sure we can have the variation to select upon. Now, the first thing that we wanted to look at was amount of phenotyping we have and still get reasonable estimates. So on this axis is how many lines out of our population can you drop? This is if you use 3 years. Okay, we have 12, 13, 14, 15 data. In this case, we're using the 12,012 trial. Okay, so we're basically taking the 3 years that we don't have, these lines, the data from the 3 years that these lines are not tested in to estimate the line, okay? If you look at this one, it's with using the other 3 years' data exclusively. This one would be 10% dropped lines, and I guess really the key one is here is 50%. That's where you're using 50% of this year's data plus all of your past data, all of your other year data, okay? Idea being, can we improve our estimates? Clearly we can. If you're using three-year data and estimating the fourth year, you have a very low prediction capability. Okay, but if you can add in some data from the year you're working with, you get a fairly good thing. Now, of course, we had all full data. Okay. Now, it looks like if we drop 50% of our lines for phenotyping, we could get by. That's what the take-home message of this is. We did the same thing on the other 3 years, okay? And there's basically you see the same trends. If you're going to use 3 years to estimate the fourth year, you have a very low prediction availability. Part of that is we don't have a good enough training population, okay? okay? But we're getting better. Okay?
This year is important to me because if you look at the selection, the indices are very low compared to the other years, which were more normal.
2012, the previous year, when I had to do only phenotypic selection, because we were phenotyping on this nursery, or genotyping on this nursery, now we do the year before, okay? We had a very early year, very unrepresentative, and you can see that what I selected basically wasn't very good. That's that uniformly bad data, okay? Now, can genomic selection reduce your phenotyping cost by doing only a subset of lines? The answer is well documented previously and by others in our trials, yes. Can we get away without phenotyping at all? The answer is probably not very well. Not yet. Okay? But this is an interesting slide, again, of how you use your data. So you have here your phenotypic observed values. You have your estimated breeding values here. Okay? You probably can't see it, but there's a slew of small red dots. That's the first year's trial. Then if you go to the green triangles, that happens to be what got advanced to the second year. Okay? If you go to the green squares, that was what was advanced to the third year. If you then go to these little plus signs, which you barely can see, that was advanced to the fourth year. And if you go to the fifth year, you see these two squares with an X in them. What you're seeing is that when you have your first raw data, you have tremendous diversity. Of course, as you get better phenotypic data, you start moving above the phenotypic observed values. You want to be above the average. But what's interesting is with the genomic estimates, we're also more and more going to this quadrant. Okay? And that quadrant is where it looks like our selections finally end up. So even though we have poor genomic predictability as of now, it's helping us. That's the take-home message there. And it works in every year. Now, every year we don't have the full 5 years of data because in 2012 we can go to 2016. 2013, you can go a little bit further, but you can't, you know, you'll have the 13, 14, 15, and 16. 14, you just have 14, 15, and 16. And in 15, you just have 15 and 16. But basically, once again, in every one of these, we're gravitating to this upper quadrant. That's the take-home message. And that quadrant is defined not by only by the phenotypic values, but by the genomic estimated breeding values. So lines with high GEV and observed values are retained. That's what it comes down to. And that matching is becoming quite interesting. Will it improve our selection accuracy? Absolutely. Can we recycle lines? Because one of the things we want to speed our breeding program up with is to move more quickly to the crossing block. This we think we can. So we're now using lines a generation earlier that we think should be better, even though we haven't got all the phenotypic data, so we're making better crosses. Can we skip a year of phenotypic? Not yet. Okay? But we're getting closer. This slide is basically a repeat of the other slide with one exception. We're only using 50% of the data from any year. So we wanted to go back to see if what happens if you reduce the number of lines you're phenotyping and you're getting the exact same results. So again, you can go back and reduce your phenotyping if you have to. Okay? So, and our accuracy is going to get better. Conclusions. Adjusting for spatial variation in oxenic designs is huge. Okay? GBS can provide a high number of very good quality SNPs. Low predictability, which we have today, but we're going to get better at, doesn't mean that genomic selection is ineffective. It's a nice supplementary tool. Selecting lines with above genomic estimated breeding values or genetic estimated breeding values and observed phenotypes increases our accuracy and allows us to pick lines earlier. Okay? With our current training sets, we can't skip a year. And I don't think we'd ever really want to because I think you always want to recalibrate. It does assist in selections. Now, the things we're going to look at in the future, okay, is how can we develop algorithms where we test in one site and predict in the other two ecozones? How can we use the data that comes from the preliminary yield trial to further help us work with the preliminary observation trial? So we need data from each year, but it doesn't have to be the data from the trial you're working in. We have routine trials that are much better replicated that can be done in the same years. Can we come back? And then, of course, we're going to really look at the genotype by environmental interactions. Think we're doing okay, Tom? Okay. Now, this is my Don Quixote part, okay? The final frontier, hybrid wheat, okay? And I want to show you how genomic selection can really make a difference in this area. This is a key interest that I personally have, okay? Hybrid wheat was or is grown in India, South Africa, Europe, U.S., and Australia. Right now, the largest markets are probably in Europe. There's a little bit in India, and there has been some in Australia. And we think in the future there'll be quite a bit of efforts in the U.S. The seed costs are very high, and lower levels of heterosis are major hindrances to bringing hybrid wheat to market. There's been a lot of work with chemical hybridizing agents, okay, but the cytoplasmic male sterility systems appear to be the most efficacious and reliable. Restoration's been a problem, but we think with better tools we can get that nailed down. If you're going to develop a hybrid wheat system, you're going to need three things. Excellent pollinators for cross-pollination, you're going to need receptive females, and then you're going to need heterotic groupings. You've never seen what this looks like. This is a CMS male, a female, pardon me. The gape on the glumes, the stigmas are extruding. They are ready to be pollinated. This is a partial restore where we didn't get complete restoration. And this is a restored line in the cytoplasm, sterile cytoplasm, fully restored. So we have the nuts and bolts there. We also have wind at 8 o'clock in the morning, which is critical for cross-pollination. That's what Nebraska is famous for. This is really interesting work on how we're going to go after getting the heterotic pools. Okay? So first of all, this little graph here is if you have a certain number of inbreds and you want to make biparental hybrids, how many hybrids you'd have to make. And you can see it's an exponential rise. It clearly overwhelms you. And that's in part why we had two heterotic groups developed in maize, is to cut down so you knew which sides to work with. Okay? This is a balanced missing mating design. And this is really slick. Okay? It was developed by the people at Hohenheim and IPK, okay, in Europe. If you have dense marker data on the parents, and you can phenotype a set, but not the complete set, just a set of experimental hybrids, you can estimate all of the potential hybrids. That's what they're trying to do. Okay? And this work was published in PNAS, if you want to find the citation. We have a collaboration with Texas A&M University. Each of us put in 25 males and 50 females to get a total of 50 males and 100 females. Okay? From that, you can create 11,175 hybrids. Be a little tough to get a graduate student to work on that. Okay? But we do have brave graduate students. But we can create 700 hybrids. We take 25 males. We take 100 females, okay, and each male is crossed to 14 females. Now, each male doesn't get the same 14 females, so all 100 are represented in the 25 male by female crosses. And we do that at two locations because in the Great Plains, catastrophes can happen. Our trials look good right now. In Texas, they're planting with no moisture in the first 5 inches of the soil, okay? We have to buffer, okay? We will evaluate the 700 hybrids, okay, and we will be able to estimate 10,475 hybrids from that trial because of the algorithms our colleagues and cooperators in Germany have developed, okay? So we're going to use the estimated breeding points to start building our heterotic pools. Now, the other thing is even if we have a catastrophe where we lose one of our crossing blocks, we can still estimate from the other crossing block, 7,750 hybrids. That's unbelievable. So all the data where we showed you about having data and then predicting, you know, how much can we do, 50% missing, this is exactly what happens. We're going to have hybrids. Some will be made. Some will be predicted. And that's how we're going to go after hybrid wheat and trying to find the heterotic pools, which is by far the most difficult part to work with. So this is something that only genomic selection and the post-sequence era would allow us to do. And I just think when you can look at estimating 700 and then predicting over 10,000. Now, we may need to tweak that because you may want to have 10% of your predictions to predict the other 90. But it's unbelievable what capabilities are. Plus, we'll use our genomic selection on our R lines to know where the R genes are. Because that's also important. That's where we're going to track it. We don't need Cas markers. Now, that's going to leave me with the last thing. Oh, man, what did I do? Oh, yeah, the difference between tactics and strategy. Okay? The questions breeders ask and how we weight them is our strategy. That's our goals and objectives. How we go about answering these questions, those are our tactics. Now, genomics and the post-sequence era won't change the questions. It doesn't change our strategy. But my gosh, it's going to change our tactics. And that's the take-home message that I want you to understand. We're still asking the questions, the unreplicated designs, how you transfer data from a location to a location where it's not tested. These types of things don't change. With that, I'll say thank you.
Okay, so we have time for some questions, and I do want to mention we're going to have 15 minutes at the end of the third talk where all three speakers will come up to the podium and address some questions, and we can have a discussion. But we do have time if anyone has a question for Steve.
Hey, Roy, come on. What's your question? Okay, the question is an excellent one. Is with 700 hybrids are we over predicting? Is there a validation step? The answer is we can certainly validate the hybrids that we have, okay? The other answer is that that work's been done in Germany, and they have a larger data set. They've been longer in the hybrids. They have validated it. And really, that PNAS paper is excellent, and they've got all the supplementary data, so you can really go in with a fine-tooth comb and see all that. So the answer will be, yes, we're going to have to validate it. Yes, we're going to have to verify it. Yes, we're going to have to make sure it works in our situation, okay? But everything we've seen so far says, this is pretty cool. Okay, well, in Nebraska, if it winter kills in my plots, that's fine. If it winter kills in a commercial field, that's my error, okay? So we generally don't have stand issues, okay? So that's that one thing. The ability to work with a component of yield, which would be the number of tillers per meter squared, things like that, I think is a nice covariate, okay? We definitely, and in our one of the grants we have submitted, we definitely have a link to high-throughput phenotyping. And so the answer would be, I'd like to see that. Because, you know, there's things like, if you look at heterosis, can you use early vigor as a surrogate for heterosis later on? If you have a fixed harvest index, then biomass should be related to the endpoint yield, right? If you're going to breed for a dual purpose wheat where it's grazed in Oklahoma and then let go to seed, then the biomass becomes huge, okay? And so, absolutely, I think these kinds of covariates would be extremely valuable. Okay.
Time for one more. Anyone has one? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.